It's time now to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr., family medicine physician Dr. George J. Patruncio, and well-known philanthropist Cal Rudman team up to bring you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. This could be the most important radio show you'll ever listen to. Now, here are Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr., Dr. George Patruncio, and Cal Rudman on Inside Medicine.
Welcome, everybody. We are very happy to present this program today. This is going to be very helpful for many, many people. We do want to note that the vaccines, two of them are out, approved by the FDA. We do want to say that Rowan University actually will be dispensing the vaccine for this deadly agent. We want to note that these two companies within 48 hours had their vaccines into the FDA for consideration. The Chinese released the molecular molecule of the virus, and these guys were right at it. So we have to be incredibly thankful for American ingenuity, and we salute pharma. Today we have the Dean of Rowan University School of Medicine, Dr. Thomas Cavalieri. He has received the American Osteopathic Association's Distinguished Service Certificate. This is the highest honor that anybody can get in this business. He has shown significant leadership in geriatrics, osteopathic medical education, and with the help of Josh Corin and other members of the faculty, is now going to be doing COVID vaccinations at Rowan University. Dr. Cavalieri is a geriatric educator, superb clinician, an individual who always listens. He basically has been renowned nationally for geriatrics. He has been recognized as a top doc in Philadelphia Magazine, New Jersey Monthly, South Jersey Magazine, et cetera, et cetera. And the one thing about Dr. Cavalieri, Dean Cavalieri, is that he knows how to listen and is superb at that. He's going to be associated with the head of family medicine, Dr. Joshua Corin, an MBA, FACOFP. He is the interim dean of clinical affairs, chair and professor of the Department of Family Medicine at Rowan. So we have a fantastic program because they've got something to tell you. I do want to note that in-hospital mortality is three times higher with COVID-19 and that we need this vaccine. Dr. Cavalieri and Dr. Corin, welcome to Inside Medicine. Well, we have you guys on the line.
Thank you.
Thanks much.
Joe, thank you for hosting this.
Listen, it's my pleasure. You guys have done great work, and Rowan is moving forward. So let me ask the first question. Why did your medical school decide to work with the Department of Health to establish the Regional 19 Vaccination Clinic?
Yeah, Joe, first let me thank you, Cal, and George for hosting this today. It's critical that we get information out about this vaccine because what will really stop this pandemic is people getting vaccinated. So we need buy-in, and providing education such as this is critical, so we're thankful. The reason why we got into this is because it's integral to our mission. The mission of our school, the Rowan University School of Osteopathic Medicine, is to improve the health of the communities we serve through education, through clinical care, and through research. When we had the opportunity and we were asked, would we want to host the site on our campus right there in Stratford, Camden County, it was a no-brainer. We can do this. We must do this. We're actually entitling this mission Operation Save Lives because this is a deadly disease, as you well know, as you're seeing yourself. And the hope for stopping this deadly disease is vaccination. So it was integral to our mission. I have to say the faculty at our medical school, our staff, our students all came together and said, we are going to do this, and we're geared up to begin very soon. We're excited about it. And I tell our students, every injection you give, it's the possibility that you save the life. So that's why we're doing it, improve the health of our community, provide education, because there's a lot of education. As you know, there is a reluctance by many to get this vaccine. So we need to educate, we need to administer this vaccine, and of course, research is needed too. So we're excited about moving forward.
So there's two vaccines, Dean, and of course, Dr. Corin. Are there any differences between them? Because both Moderna's and Pfizer and the German company BioNTech were approved. Are there any differences from your perspective?
Well, first and foremost, good morning again, and thanks for having myself and Dean Cavalieri. Yeah, there are two vaccines approved, the Pfizer and BioNTech and the Moderna vaccines at this point through FDA and recently through the emergency use authorization. The vaccines are actually more alike than they're different, especially for the members of our general public. So both vaccines utilize what we call the messenger RNA technology, meaning that they teach cells to make a protein that will prompt an immune response. And really, if you look at these two, the efficacy rates, which are protecting against COVID-19, are almost identical in that 94-95% range. So that similarity exists between both Moderna and the Pfizer BioNTech. They were also effective for different races and genders, as well as people with underlying medical conditions. The side effects were very similar, and they were mostly generally mild and temporary, including pain at the site of injection, headaches, fever, fatigue, chills, muscle aches, and joint pains. These typically are symptoms that were very temporary, and they were similar in both vaccines. Now, the differences are that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was approved by the FDA for age 16 and up, whereas Moderna is 18 and up. So that's one key difference. And that the second difference is that the frequencies of shots that you receive, there are two shots for both vaccines. Pfizer is 3 weeks apart, and Moderna is 4 weeks apart. The last big difference is you probably have heard about the storage needs as far as temperature controls. So the Pfizer vaccine needs to be at a negative 70 degrees Celsius. That's really cold, and it's not your typical freezer that you would see at not only in your home, but also in any medical office that's around the country. So these freezers are specifically lab freezers or pharmaceutical grade freezers that get down there. That's for that Pfizer BioNTech. For Moderna, it's not nearly as cold, so they can actually get away with the negative 20 degree zone. So it's a much different temperature between the two. And even within the handling of those vaccines, temperatures are very, very critical because messenger RNA degrades quickly if it's not controlled at a certain temperature. So those are really the key similarities and differences between both the Pfizer and BioNTech and the Moderna vaccines.
But what you're stressing is that they both work incredibly well at a high percentage, 94-95%. They need to get a second vaccination, and they need to wait, is it 2 weeks, to make sure that they are safe from the vaccine? Josh, could you just help us out on that?
Yeah, so typically the initial symptoms that people are going to have may pop up over the first days, and they're, again, temporary and transient, because you're trying to create an immune response that's similar to the vaccine's going to get your body ready to fight the disease. So some of these things your body does to fight the virus makes you feel a little bit under the weather, and that's usually going to be within the first days. And then in that first couple weeks, typically you're gonna make sure that the patients have no other reactions. We'll talk a little bit later about if there's a reaction, how that would be reported. But those gaps of time, the 0 and 3 weeks and 0 and 4 weeks, are both what the intervals are needed for both the first and second shots, and to get that efficacy of 95%, which is really amazing as far as the percent efficacy in these two vaccines.
So will Rowan University, Rowan Osteopathic Medicine, be offering both vaccines?
Joe,
are someone going to have a choice?
No, Joe. We're going to be administering initially the Moderna. And, of course, as you just said, it was just approved. And we're expecting a shipment very, very soon. We don't know if it will be tomorrow or Monday, but we are so prepared that when we receive it the very next day, we are able to administer it. We actually have, you know, some of the first people to receive it scheduled, and as if we would be getting it on Monday. But we're in close touch with the Department of Health of the state, as well as the Camden County Health Department. So we are really going to be administering Moderna as of now. However, we are so well prepared that we told the Department of Health that we are prepared to administer the Pfizer as well. As Dr. Corin, as Josh just mentioned, you know, there is a requirement for deep freeze. And not everybody has the deep freeze where you could freeze things at 80 degrees minus Celsius. So we have these facilities. So we're working with the state. We're going to start with Moderna, but if there's a need, we can handle both. And as a matter of fact, I think a little later we may be discussing, are there any other vaccines in sight? One thing that our site at the medical school offers is that we have the capability through our clinical enterprise, as well as our research enterprise, to handle any of these vaccines that may be forthcoming. So we are prepared, and we will be starting with Moderna.
Fantastic. So, Cal, I think you want to chime in about a basic question.
Yes. How safe are these vaccines?
Cal, this is it's a great question. And any vaccine that goes through the scrutiny of the FDA and all the panels that go after the FDA have to prove efficacy, safety, and then immune response, specifically how the immune response is proximate to the vaccine. Safety is key, so it has to make we have to make sure that what we're putting out to the public for use is a safe vaccine. Both of these vaccines went through the scrutiny of the FDA, and certainly, as I mentioned, there are common side effects that were seen in the clinical trials. These are involving some 44,000 people. And again, they included those symptoms of pain and fatigue, and we call them constitutional symptoms. These are symptoms that typically are chills and fever that may occur, but they're very temporary and very transient. There were not serious, adverse, unusual events that were reported. So all of the side effects were very, very much transient, temporary, that go away in a few days. Now, because these vaccines and their approvals are so new, these companies that have put them to the FDA for approval are going to continue to study longer-term safety, efficacy, and immune response. So they have very, very strict criteria where if anybody has an adverse reaction, they can be reported right back to the two companies. And that is, there's a vaccine adverse event program that everyone who gets the vaccine will have the opportunity to register any adverse reactions directly into a system so there could be continued monitoring both within the trial as well as within the public.
So I just want to state the word efficacy means how efficacious, how well it works. So these, as just to just restage it, they said it's 94-95% efficacy, or it gets the job done 94-95% of the time. So that's very impressive, and you can see safety is very important. But what Dr. Corin has already stated is that these side effects are usually are what occur with all vaccines. Nothing outstanding is in the way. Let me just move on. Why are the elderly at such increased risk for getting COVID-19?
Yeah, Joe, I'll handle that one. As you know, I'm a geriatrician. That's my field, caring for older adults. And yes, they are at higher risk and significantly. And a statistic I came across recently regarding nursing home patients, and of course, we're hearing all the time how vulnerable nursing home patients are to this disease, but we basically, for example, nationwide, people who live and reside in nursing homes represent less than 1% of the population, yet they account for 40% of the deaths. So this is an extremely vulnerable population. But even older people who are not in nursing homes are at higher risk. For example, if you look at people between the ages of 50 and 64, they are four times more likely to get hospitalized and actually 30 times more likely to die than individuals between the ages of 18 and 29. So this is a disease, of course, that could affect almost any age, but obviously how it affects older people is really much greater. Well, why is this? Well, first of all, the immune system declines with age. This has been well documented for many years, that just on the basis of aging alone, our immune system isn't as effective. That's part of the normal aging process, and that's been well described. But it's not only that. We also know that having other comorbidities or other diseases puts one at increased risk. So as we know, as people age, the likelihood of having many chronic disorders, be it diabetes, heart disease, kidney failure, that type of thing, increases with age. So basically what we have is the effects of declining in the immune system with age, plus comorbidities that occur with age coming together to result in older adults being more vulnerable to this disorder, both in terms of getting it, as well as the impact of the disease as well. So it's going to be particularly important too that the older people who have comorbidities take this vaccine.
So I do think it's just important just to just buff up a little bit what the dean just said, because take, for instance, obesity, and the FDA reduced the definition of obesity from 35 down to 30, and the mortality is about a third higher for anybody who has obesity, who gets to the point where they need respirator assistance. So we don't want any more COVID-19 catches. We want to make sure that everybody gets out and does their walking and just takes a look at really what they're going to eat. So just remember, those comorbidities do add up, and we want to make sure that everybody would use this program to plot a new plan to making sure their health is at the top line level. If someone had a reaction to a flu vaccine, should they take the COVID-19 vaccine? That's going to be a tough question that comes up in the office all the time.
Yeah, Joe, it is a great question. And the short answer is yes, but with caveat. So the caveat is that the CDC recently came out just on this past Sunday saying that those people who have had severe reactions to vaccines or injectable drugs can still get the Pfizer vaccine for COVID-19, but they should discuss the risks with their doctors and be monitored for 30 minutes after getting the shot instead of the 15 minutes for the general population. And this is really something that we should talk a little bit about. So normally the wait period is 15 minutes because only about one out of every 1 million people who get a vaccine can have a severe allergic reaction. That's for normal vaccine protocols. So in this case, because it's so new, if somebody has had a past history of a severe allergic reaction, they're recommending a 30-minute period of time for observation. The vaccine that Pfizer has put out, Pfizer BioNTech, has 10 ingredients. Messenger RNA is one of them, which is naturally found in human cells and is unlikely to pose a threat as far as the allergies. The other 9 ingredients are a mix of salts, fatty substances, sugars that help stabilize the vaccine. And none of these are common allergens. The only chemical with a history of causing allergic reactions in the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine is polyethylene glycol, which is something that if for those who are in the audience, is in common medications over the counter like Miralax, which is used for sometimes for colonoscopy preps or cleanouts. That is the only one. So if there's a history of polyethylene glycol allergy, again, that needs to be discussed with a physician, recognizing that that may or may not cause any type of reaction. But these parts of or ingredients in these vaccines really don't produce an allergic response that's severe. So when we're looking at it from vaccine to vaccine, right now there's no contraindication to getting the COVID-19 vaccines. If you've had a reaction, it is, though, recommended to discuss this with a physician. And certainly if you've had severe allergic reactions, to stay for 30 minutes. One other point, there's some recent data where there's some people in the UK, United Kingdom, and Alaska that have had some severe allergic reactions. At least a few of these have already had prior hospitalizations for severe allergic reactions from other types of vaccines in the past. And then they subsequently got the COVID-19 vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, and they were admitted to the hospital. Each of them, after treatment with epinephrine, which helps the allergic response pathway to settle down, and supplemental oxygen and steroids, all recovered fast and were discharged. But it is important to note that if you have a severe allergic reaction, that you do want to talk to your physician to make sure that you are a candidate. And look at the risks and benefits. We know the risks of COVID-19. They're very evident, and there's a lot of data on that at this point. And certainly, as I mentioned, this one in a million on the risks of a severe allergic reaction from a vaccine, we know that there's much higher than one in a million risk for morbidity and mortality from COVID-19.
So fantastic data. I have to, point out that I've had a number of patients die from COVID. It does kill people. It kills husband and wife. Just 2 days ago, the retired chief nurse at the hospital I practice at was with her husband, and I got a call a few days later that both she died in the hospital from COVID, and a day later her husband died. Now, they may have been 85, but you just hate to see people who worked their whole life, did great for medicine, and then all of a sudden die. So to follow up, this is a nasty, and it's got residual issues. So I see people just don't want to get the vaccine. They refuse the vaccine, even some who are healthcare professionals. Any idea why that thought process has evolved?
Well, Joe, it's multifactorial. For this particular vaccine, there are some out there that believe it was rushed, that it wasn't studied as long as other vaccines, that it was pushed through, so to speak. That's a concern. So there are people that are saying, I'm not going to take it. I want to wait and see how others do. There are others that just have misconceptions to vaccines. For example, I have some patients that refuse the flu vaccine, even though I strongly recommend it, because they say, well, I had it once and I got the flu. But the reality of it is that many vaccines, like, say, the influenza vaccine, may only have a 60 or 70% efficacy, which means that you still could get the flu even though you had the vaccine. But just think of it. These vaccines are reporting a 90-95% efficacy. So, but some people have that misconception, or sometimes they'll get the vaccine and get a cold, and they'll think that is a result of getting the vaccine. So there are many, many reasons why this might be the case. But I think for these vaccines, there is a concern that it hasn't been studied long enough, and there may be other more severe side effects that emerge when it's used, longer. I do think, though, that that even though, as you said, it's almost like a medical miracle that we've been able to produce these quickly, But I think it's because of the expertise and the scientific ingenuity that we have here in this country. I do believe the data is there. In fact, the panels that have okayed this for emergency usage, both of them, for Moderna, it was 20-0 in favor. For the Pfizer, I think it was 16 or 17 to 3 or 4. And the reason why is because they weren't comfortable with it going down to age 16 for the Pfizer. So as was mentioned, it's 18 and up for Moderna, 16 and up for Pfizer. And there was a concern that maybe there wasn't enough data in the 16 to 18 group. But for some individuals too, there are some ethical concerns. And one of the ethical concerns that is spoken of is some of these vaccines are, the cell lines are derived from aborted fetuses. And there are some ethical implications there. Although from my review of the literature and from an ethical perspective, this does not apply to these vaccines. But some people do raise that concern about an ethical issue related to the use of vaccines that are derived from cell lines taken from aborted fetuses. This does not apply to these vaccines.
Thank you, Dean Cavalieri. I do want to point out that this technology, which has just been blown wide open, is going to basically be applied to many other disease processes, such as Ebola, which basically, you know, kills many people, especially in Africa. So this technology is absolutely fascinating, a tremendous move forward for mankind, and we have to really just, you know, bow down and say thank you, Pfizer, thank you, BioNTech, thank you, Moderna, and everybody else who's coming, J&J, et cetera. So just moving on, just remember, this is cutting edge, we're moving forward, and this is going to be used for many other disease processes, mankind moving forward. Cal, I think you've got a very important question.
Yes. Should pregnant women receive the vaccine?
Cal, thank you for that question. So at this point, there's limited data about the safety of COVID-19 vaccines for people who are pregnant. That being said, while studies have not yet been done, based on how the messenger RNA vaccines work, experts believe that they are unlikely to pose a risk for people who are pregnant. Keep in mind, the messenger RNA vaccines do not contain live virus that causes COVID-19 and therefore cannot give somebody COVID-19. Additionally, messenger RNA vaccines don't interact with any of our genetic material, DNA, because the messenger RNA does not enter into the nucleus of the cell. Therefore, it's not going to change your DNA at all. However, the potential risks of any of these vaccines to pregnant persons and their fetus are unknown because these vaccines have not yet been studied in pregnant women. There are some healthcare professionals right now that have received the vaccine that are pregnant and have notified their physicians. Looking at the risks and benefits based off of their occupation and exposure, but there are limited data as far as the safety of these vaccines in people who are pregnant.
So Josh, just to try and just dwell down on that, what you're saying, this is a piece of the virus. The virus, this just makes your own endogenous immune system respond and knock out the complete virus if you were so challenged. But this can't give it because it's just a snippet of a strand that usually goes inside a cell and starts making proteins. Did I paraphrase that right?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Just again, keeping in mind, it's just getting your body ready to fight the disease, and it's not an actual live virus. It's just trying to help your body recognize if the proteins that are on the virus come into your system. It will help create a response so that way your body can fight against it. So this is, there's no live virus material that's in this because this is considered a it's the first of its type, as the dean mentioned before, this messenger RNA technology, but it does not interact with any of our genetic material that we call DNA, because RNA does not enter into the nucleus or the inside part of the cell. It just helps to create a response to help fight the virus if it does come into your system.
So moving forward, what about someone who is breastfeeding? Issues there or unknown?
Yeah, so you know, another important question, and each of these questions are still being looked at. So COVID-19 vaccines are not something that has data on safety for lactating women or on any of the effects of mRNA vaccines, messenger RNA vaccines like the Pfizer BioNTech or Moderna on the breastfed infant or any milk production. And that being said, there's not any thought to be a risk to the breastfeeding infant. They just have not studied them. There were no studies that were part of this initial core 40,000 plus group. So people who are breastfeeding and are part of that recommended healthcare group, this category 1A group, which is the healthcare professionals, are recommended to receive a COVID-19 vaccine, and they may choose to be vaccinated even if they are breastfeeding. And again, it is something that you should talk to your physician about, but there's no indications that say that there's any adverse reactions or events to either the patient or to the child.
So Dean and Josh, I have to say this, the next question, you may not want to give out your phone number ever, but for administrating a vaccine at Rowan, will you guys got you in there, be prioritizing who should receive the vaccine? Remember, no phone numbers.
So, yeah, I could start there, and I know the dean may have some comments as well. What the phases that have been rolled out from state include are examples in phase 1A, which is right now ongoing, of healthcare setting and eligible personnel that could get it. And I'd like to share some examples, and this is really good for the audience to know how expansive this list looks like. So healthcare personnel that would be included in this in New Jersey are licensed healthcare professionals like doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and dentists. These obviously have a lot of high touch points with patients in a direct aspect. But certainly staff like receptionists in an office, medical office, janitors in a medical office or hospital, clergy in a hospital, mortuary services and lab technicians have indirect, and they are also recommended in phase 1A in New Jersey. Anybody who is an unpaid worker, like a health professional student, these are our medical students, nursing students, those who have high touch points directly in the hospitals or in offices, any trainees, any volunteers that work in our volunteer clinics that we're opening up, and any essential caregivers that provide care to patients in homes, all are 1A. Community healthcare workers, such as doulas, public health professionals, and the most needed, and I would encourage people to think about this, because we're in a shortage in the country right now, Medical Reserve Corps. These are the people that we call upon during times like this, which have been never in most of our lives. The Medical Reserve Corps helps out with these initiatives for right now pandemic response to give vaccines to people, to help register patients, to get involved. And I would encourage you to go find a local resource to register if you have any interest, and certainly if you've got background in any type of health profession. These are all people in Category 1A. Our personnel that are in venues like emergency medical services, like paramedics and EMS providers, they are also considered 1A. Funeral staff and autopsy workers are considered 1A. And then other paid or unpaid people who work in healthcare settings who may have any direct or indirect contact with infectious persons or materials and who cannot work for home are all considered 1A. These are all the New Jersey Department of Health requirements for phase 1A personnel. Now, the thought is that over the next 3 to 6 weeks, these healthcare personnel will be in the first queue to get their vaccines. As soon as that first queue is done, the state will report that the second part, which is going to be our other essential workers who are non-healthcare providers, will start to then come in. Those would include law enforcement, government, water sanitation, teachers, including education and childcare, transportation workers, food and energy, food and agriculture, and also others in various types of essential worker, non-healthcare capacity. Once those two phases are done, we'll move to the 65-year and plus population. There's a lot of discussion that this may be in the time frame around March. So if you think about the first phase may go right through mid-January to end of January. The second phase with the non-healthcare workers will probably be in that time frame of late January through the end of February. Adults at higher risk, these are long-term healthcare residents, 65 years and older, any type of immunocompromised patients, those who live in group homes, they are all at higher risk. They would be the following phase. And then the last phase would be the general population, which would include adults over age 18 for Moderna, over 16 for Pfizer, BioNTech. That would be everyone from colleges and universities, people who are living in the communities. And that would probably start sometime late spring, depending on the rollouts and supply of the vaccine.
Josh and Joe, if I could just comment on that too. So Joe, I mean, you did raise a good question here, but the reality of it is that we're simply following the guidelines of the state health department. So that's how we're rolling it out. But the reality of it is in a few months, this will be open to the general community. It's just prioritizing those who are at highest risk and also those who are at high risk of perhaps spreading this because they're in contact with patients, et cetera. You know, it's very interesting, though. Some controversy has already arisen. I learned just a few hours ago that Stanford University has decided not to immunize its medical residents, the residents who are employed by the hospital and provide care. And of the 150 residents they have, only 7 of them were going to be immunized. And of course, this has created a lot of controversy and protests already. I understand they revised their decision on that, but quite frankly, you know, at our institution, our residents are often first line caring for patients, many with COVID. So our residents are included in the 1A as well. The other thing that's varying from state to state are medical students. Our guidelines call for unlicensed individuals who have patient contact to be fit into 1A. So in New Jersey, medical students and nursing students are eligible for this. And when you really think of it, these medical students, if they're fourth year, they're going to be graduating in a few months. They're going to become residents, and they're going to be part of the physician workforce. So personally, I think New Jersey's making the right decision by including medical students initially, and certainly residents. I think that was a clear mistake, and I think Stanford has already revised its approach. But the bottom line is, fortunately, Josh or I or our colleagues don't have to make these decisions. We're following the guidelines of the state of New Jersey, which, quite frankly, I think makes a lot of good sense.
Thank you for that clarification, Dr. Cavalieri. So what about those patients who want to be hit-and-run types? Because you mentioned that this requires 2 injections, and I would assume following directions makes the most amount of sense here with a 95% efficacy. How far apart should these injections be, and is it very important to make sure you get that second injection? Because I don't think there's any proof that one injection is going to do it, but you guys know more about this than me, so if you guys can please help us out on that question.
Absolutely. So again, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is spread out between 3 weeks, so you get shot one today, for instance, and shot two in 3 weeks. For Moderna, you get shot one today and shot one in 4 weeks. So they have a slightly different spread between shots one and two. To your question, Joe, the efficacy, there is some efficacy that occurs with one shot for at least the data that's out there for Pfizer, but it's not nearly what that 95% efficacy gives you with the second shot. So the clinical trial data shows that at least at 3 months out, people are still having that same efficacy with two shots. It is not for these two vaccines something that you can get away with just one shot and the efficacy and protection will be there for you. So like you just said, you want to make sure that, you know, you adhere to getting those two shots, because the clinical data that came out shows that 95% of the population who gets this is going to be protected against COVID-19 versus one shot, which maybe it's much, much less efficacious just getting one shot of either one of those two.
Yeah, the other thing is that by doing the right thing, i.e. two shots, which is recommended, you're actually going to be helping your fellow mankind, because you want to make sure that you are one of those people who is going to be included in the herd immunity. So can you guys explain herd immunity to the group? Because I think that's very important, and it pushes the need to make sure that whoever gets a shot gets the shot the right way so that they can help their other fellow mankind. Herd immunity.
I can take a stab at that. First, let me comment before we move on to that, because I think what I'm saying here really relates to this one-shot, two-shot, requirement. I get asked this a lot as a physician recently is, will this cover me for life? Or is this going to be like the influenza vaccine every year? I mean, that's a commonly asked question. And you know what the answer to that, Joe, is? We simply don't know. I mean, obviously, people get some vaccinations that are a one-time deal, say the shingles vaccine. Polio vaccine, even the pneumovax, the pneumonia vaccine, it went from once in a lifetime, then every 5 years, now it's back to, once, that type of thing. We just don't know with COVID-19. I mean, hopefully it will give us immunity for a long time, lifetime, who knows? But the other hand, there may be varying strains of this, and the requirement for repeat vaccinations down the road. It's something we just don't know at this point. You know, your question about herd immunity is really an important one. Of course, epidemic is when a disease becomes widespread in a community, and pandemic, what we're dealing with now is essentially very widespread. It really becomes worldwide. And we see the devastation that is so widespread. Herd immunity really is a concept that when individuals in a community, a large community, have immunity to a certain disease, it simply prevents the widespread nature of an illness. So essentially, what we're dealing with COVID, it's spread from human to human. And if there isn't an extensive amount of immunity within the population, then it becomes widespread, so widespread that it really becomes a pandemic worldwide, that type of thing. So herd immunity actually implies that much of the population is immune to this disease, that it can't get it because their body is able to provide the defenses to keep them from getting it. And then therefore, it doesn't spread from one to another to another to another, which is exactly what we see. Now, this underscores the absolute need for people to get vaccinated, because this is how we really develop herd immunity. Now, it's basically said, those who will really study epidemiology, that we need about 70% compliance with this vaccine to develop enough herd immunity to really end this pandemic. So that's why we feel so strongly about this, and we want to really immunize as many people as we could and encourage people to get immunized, because to really make the impact that we'd like to make, 70% of the population would need to be immunized.
Thank you, Dean Cavalieri. That is, I'm glad you emphasized that. Fantastic. Cal Rudman is on the line, and he has a question.
Yes. Are there other vaccines in the pipeline?
Cal, it's a great question. So right now, interestingly, there are about 150 vaccines that are being studied. 50 of them are currently in human trials. And again, those human trials go through multiple phases of evaluation before they get approved by the FDA to assess safety, efficacy, and that immune response system response to the vaccine. So the big vaccines that have been approved, we talked about the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. There are some others that are going to probably be evaluated once they get through their latest stage, this phase 3 trial, which has typically 30 to 80,000 patients enrolled. Companies such as Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca that are in that later stage. But right now, there are actually 50 that are in human trials around the world right now, with many of the big companies focusing on now the second and third phases of these trials. So we should be hearing in the next month or two about some of these other companies that may be pursuing FDA approval.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
so we're going to have different. Go ahead, Dean Cavalieri.
Oh, I just wanted to bring up a point. Josh, I understand some of these vaccines that are being studied may just be a one injection approach. Is that your understanding?
Right. So one of the vaccines Johnson & Johnson has, they have actually a couple different arms of the study. One of them is a one injection vaccine that they're looking at that's, again, in clinical trial stage, which would certainly help with the compliance, getting one versus two. But that is not yet approved. And if it does get cleared, it's probably not going to be until late winter that there's a potential that it does go up for FDA approval.
And that would certainly make a difference in compliance, I'm sure.
Well, and we're looking forward to that. And I think that J&J announced this week that they were able to reduce their amount of people in their study from 60,000 to 40,000 because of the increase in COVID in the community. So when there's more COVID cases, they don't need to test as many people. So it's bad that we have an increase in COVID, and everybody's just got to, you know, basically stop bad behavior. But at least they're going to see their vaccine will go a little quicker, hopefully, to resolution of the answer, and hopefully it'll be a one-shot deal. When and how will members in the community be able to access COVID-19 vaccination at Rowan University in Stratford, New Jersey? When and how?
So we're really sure. Thanks, Joe. We're really excited to be a team regional member of New Jersey to help New Jersey get back on its feet. So we are going to be receiving Moderna at some point very, very soon. We are waiting for the Department of Health to let us know the receipt. And at that point, we will start with phase 1A. That's the healthcare professionals that I described before. Our intent at Rowan University is to be the first in New Jersey to bring in other healthcare workers that are not affiliated with Rowan University. Right now, and it's understandable, the hospitals are immunizing their large employee bases. Sometimes they have 8 to 15,000 employees. And each day they're giving so many vaccines to each one, and they're staggering their population so that they always have a critical mass of people that can work in the very, very busy hospital units that are seeing these COVID-19 surges. Fortunately, with our large medical school community, our support at Rowan University, we have worked tirelessly over 3 weeks to try to get ready for our start. And when we do, our goal is to open up to healthcare workers in our community. And that is something that people can start to look at, how we're going to be doing that on a website that I could provide to you, which is www.rowanmedicine, rowanmedicine.com/vaccine. So www.rowanmedicine.com/vaccine. On that website, many FAQs, frequently asked questions, can be found regarding COVID-19, regarding the vaccine, and we'll have information about what we're going to be doing regarding access for the healthcare workers in the community. As we phase forward, we are not the only ones. There are 300 sites in New Jersey that are in the various stages of development. Some of these sites are called mega sites. A mega site will probably see and process 2,000 to 3,000, maybe 4,000 patients a day. They are in the process of putting 2 in North Jersey, 2 in Central New Jersey, and 2 in South Jersey. And I would imagine they're going to be ready to go sometime in the early phase of January. There are many large sites, and we're included in the large site. We're actually considered a large plus site, which is going to be somewhere between 2 and 300 new patients per day, and eventually, as they get their second shot, upwards of 400 to 600 patients per day. So we are hoping to open up next week once we know more about the date of receipt. We have our entire team of students, staff, faculty, and the entire Rowan University leadership, as well as our community colleges and the health-related professions, the nursing and CMA schools. This is at Rowan College of South Jersey and Rowan College of Burlington County, all understanding that we play a major pivotal role to get New Jersey back on its feet. So if there are any questions from the audience, please start to look at that website. Again, it's www.rowanmedicine.com/vaccine. That will start to answer many of your questions.
So I also want to add in that this show will be replayed at 7 a.m. on WWDB on Tuesday morning, 7 a.m. And additionally, you can go to the website of Inside Medicine, www.wwdbam.com, and you can just look on the left, hit Inside Medicine, and Dean Cavalieri and Dr. Corin's program will be live in about 2 hours up on the site. So a lot of answers there. Now, Cal has a question.
Yes, and also you can, we can give you how to reach these specialists, and I'll end with my one question here. Who receives the vaccine at Rowan, and has a reaction with there be medical care available?
So I'm sure
thank you for the question, Cal. Oh,
yes.
Thank you for the question,
Josh.
Cal. Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first question you're asking about contact, again, the website I mentioned, we will have a call center phone number. Has not been opened up yet, but that's going to be something that we will be putting out on our website as well soon. We recognize that some people have better abilities on the phone and some people have better abilities within the website aspect. So we will have access in both cases. To the question about emergencies that happen on site, We have EMS, emergency medical specialists, that will be on site every day during our open clinics, and there also will be access both to an ambulance, and we are right next to the Jefferson Stratford Hospital. We're probably all of about 250 feet away from that hospital, from the room that we're actually doing these services. We all have physicians that are on site, certified medical assistants, and we're going to have all of the trainees, fourth and third year medical students, that have basic life support training as well on site. So we feel extremely well prepared. We recognize that we're going to follow all the protocols and provisions to keep people safe right from the front door when they walk in, all the way through the clinic, which we assume that it's going to take somewhere in the vicinity of about 40 minutes to an hour to go through all the processes, registration, obviously getting the injection, and then the observation period. But we have the EMS services, emergency medical service technicians right there on site, and the ambulance as well. And our goal is to make this safe and comfortable. And really, within our walls, we feel that there's going to be many clinics out there, these mega sites that will open up, that will have massive volumes of patients going through. And there will be some large sites that will be out there. And eventually, there'll be offices, maybe in the summertime, that have vaccine in the refrigerator. Where we play a role right now is we are not a massive mega site. We're a large site that's going to be in the community serving the needs of New Jersey, those who work, those who are educated, those who live in New Jersey, as an alternate, and something that we can be proud of as Rowan University start next week.
So I want to thank you guys. I mean, you guys have been working on this from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. for the past few weeks. And I do have to report that your head of infectious disease, Dr. Lightfoot, I saw her after 7 o'clock sitting in a chair, but she still had her high heels on. So I just want you to know that. But let me just kind of get the last question. I guess it's going to be over. Don't forget, Tuesday morning, 7 o'clock, available again on WWDB. Get that website, www.wwdb.am.com. Check these guys out. Fantastic job. I thank these two physicians who did a great job, Dean Cavalieri and Dr. Joshua Corin. Joe Fallon, over and out. Thank you for listening. Let us win this battle against COVID.